Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here today. We've got a kind of a special show for you. It's a special time of the year, so we should do special shows. Special time of the year, I just want to say for two reasons. Of course, we are in the Advent season. We are anticipating Christmas Day coming up. But there's a special anticipation this year because on Christmas Eve, we start a jubilee. And since the year 1300, at first it was every 50 years, and now it's every 25 years, the Catholic Church celebrates a jubilee year. And I have become aware, as maybe if you've listened at all, you've noticed in recent weeks of the fact that we have not made enough of the jubilee year. Jubilee years are a big deal. And they're a big part of the life of the church. And so that's coming up. If you can find out all about it, they have a website for the Jubilee year. There's materials at our website. You can go to the United States Catholic Bishops. Probably your parish has information on the Jubilee year. But it's something to know about and something to keep in mind. We are on the verge of a big Jubilee, every 25-year Catholic Jubilee. In Rome, that'll mean, you know, opening the holy doors and all kinds of things. But the graces of the Jubilee year are meant for everyone, Catholic and non-Catholic, for every person around the world. And so we're getting closer. Another thing about this time of the year is people watch a lot of movies. And let's call it our semi-annual movie show. That's what we're going to do this hour. I guess that seems about right. Since we've done it twice in the last 6 months, I've decided to christen it our semi-annual movie show, and we're going to talk about movies this hour and next hour with our guest, Andrew Petiprin, a former Anglican priest. He and his family came into the Catholic Church about 5 years ago, I guess, and he's a wonderful interlocutor on all things movie. He's one of the authors of Popcorn with the Pope, a guide to the Vatican film list, a book you should get, especially if you love movies. Popcorn with the Pope, a guide to the Vatican film list. He's a columnist at the Catholic World Report. He's the host of the Ignatius Press podcast, and he's the co-founder of the Spe Salvi Institute. Andrew Petiprin, thank you very much for being here with us.
Great to be back, Cy. How are you?
I am very well. I'm as you can tell, fired up about the Jubilee year coming. I feel like we should have probably paid more attention earlier to the Jubilee year coming.
Stuff like that's great. Does the Jubilee mean all our debts are going to be forgiven, like in the Bible?
Yes, you don't have to pay your credit card bill anymore.
I'm kind of banking on that. That's kind of my financial strategy right now, Cy.
Well, let me tell you, good luck with that. All right, best of luck to you with that. I don't think there are any world governments currently recognizing the Jubilee year. Although I do remember in the Jubilee of 2000. Pope John Paul got caught up in the movement to forgive third world debt. I don't know if you remember that. That was part of the movement of the Jubilee of the year 2000.
Vaguely. I wasn't Catholic back then, and I was caught up in my own kind of young student life, so I probably didn't remember that, but that's interesting.
All right. So you still watch movies? Your father,
oh, yeah.
You're busy, you got all those jobs, but you still watch movies?
I try to watch as many movies as I can, although I have to say, Cy, 2024 was not a super great year for movies, but, you know, maybe we'll get into that.
Well, yeah, let's start there, as a matter of fact, because sometimes it's exciting to get we're going to do the movie show, there's this and there's that and there's all these things. It doesn't feel like that this year, and I'm interested to hear you say it, because, I guess there's a confirmation in that. Like, yeah, it was kind of a dull. I honestly don't remember the last time I sat in a movie theater. Nothing has drawn me into the movie theater.
Yeah, I've been a few times this year, but I have to say, 2019 was in my mind the last year where I can think of where I really enjoyed a lot of movies at the movie theater that were new movies. That was a year that, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out. That's the year that 1917 came out, Ford versus Ferrari. There are a whole bunch of good movies that year. And ever since COVID and coming out of it, there have been a few. There have been a few each year. I mean, last year we had, remember, we had, what was it called? Barbenheimer, right? We had Barbie and Oppenheimer come out.
Right.
And that was supposed to be the big event of 2023. 2024, they tried to make a big to-do out of Wicked. Maybe we'll talk about that because I have seen that one.
Wicked.
And also Gladiator Part 2, but I haven't seen that one. But, you know, I don't really think it's the same. I mean, I think they're trying to make something out of nothing.
Of course.
There's just not a whole lot of great new movies coming out.
You are probably an innocent person, but I will just share. Marketing is a big part of what they do in Hollywood. If they can just...
You know, I've heard that before. Yeah. I think you're right. I think sometimes they try to tell us things are good when they're not. Imagine that.
Yeah, I didn't see either of those, Wicked or Gladiator 2. I honestly, in my mind, I often do this like ranking of a movie when I see the trailer or the advert. Like I'm like, oh, like if I really am excited about it, I'm going to go to the theater and see that, and then I immediately assign it to I'll watch it on video, then I'll even assign them immediately when I see the trailer to. I'm not even going to watch that on video. I'm going to wait till it's on network television or something, and I accidentally catch it. I was excited to see the movie Napoleon. That was the last one I remember thinking, I want to see that in the theater. It wasn't that good.
It wasn't. I was really, Ridley Scott. I mean, I was really excited about Napoleon. I think Joaquin Phoenix, he's a strange person, but he is a good actor.
Wonderful.
And Ridley Scott has made a lot of great movies, right?
And Napoleon.
Talk about an interesting person to make a movie about. But I didn't like it at all. I thought it was it was not good from kind of a historical perspective. And it was just not good from an aesthetic perspective either. I wrote about it somewhere. But I was disappointed in Napoleon.
Yeah, I almost feel like it's hard to make a bad movie about Napoleon, but somehow they managed. And I guess one of the things about Napoleon, and this is why I thought Ridley Scott would do a good job with it, is he's very good at scale. Like a Ridley Scott movie can be grand, can be big and cover huge. And there is no person in the modern era on the scale of Napoleon. None, zero. There are no other people on his scale. And as far as the scale of life, you know, like the Napoleonic Code, you could write whole libraries just on that. And he just didn't manage it. He didn't pull it off. It wasn't there.
Yeah. I think that movie got really bogged down in kind of some, I don't know if it was, it wasn't really direct. It was kind of indirect criticism of things like patriarchy and stuff like that, violence in writ large, you know. I mean, to me, it was just kind of a movie about, you know, what a disaster one misguided man can create in the world. And well, I mean, yeah, that's sort of true about Napoleon, but I mean, that's a pretty small view, really, of such an important historical figure. So I didn't like it.
Right. What I hope someday, and I think I might have said this on the air with you before, but I don't have that many thoughts, so I recycle them. But somebody has to make a movie of the last few years of Napoleon's life, a real movie about the last few years, because he converted to the Catholic faith and died a sincere Catholic, died in friendship with the Pope who he had imprisoned and who he hated. I mean, hated Pope Pius VII. So that's a story Ridley Scott is not qualified to tell. But I wish somebody would make that movie about Napoleon.
Yeah, calling all Catholic filmmakers. Yeah. I know a few of them. I hope somebody's maybe like working away on a screenplay somewhere.
Yeah. All right, so I'll tell you what we'll do. The biggest movie of the year is probably, I don't know what it is. Actually, I'll have to ask you about that, but maybe Wicked. I know you've seen Wicked.
Yeah.
I know you haven't seen Gladiator 2. It looks exactly like Gladiator 1, except it's got Denzel Washington. I have to say, Denzel Washington has gotten me to see a lot of movies. So that's not, I don't treat that as a small thing. But other than that, it looks like the exact same movie. So I'm waiting for it on video.
Yeah, me too. That's definitely one of those that I put in the category of I'm not going to pay to see that in the movie theater unless circumstances sort of converge in such a way that this happens to me from time to time. That did not happen with Gladiator 2, but I do anticipate I'm going to watch that at some point at home because, like you, I do like Denzel Washington a lot. I think you know, I think that despite Napoleon and a few other misfires by Ridley Scott, he still has it in him to make some pretty good movies. So I don't know. We'll see. But if you're ready to talk about Wicked a little bit, I'll just say Wicked is one of those movies I did end up not at all wishing to see in the movie theater.
But you did.
But I ended up seeing it in anyway. Yeah.
All right. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll leave that as the tease. We'll take the first break. We'll be back in about 60 seconds and we'll get your take on Wicked, the movie, which I now understand is Wicked Part 1, which seems like a scam to me. But I'll ask you about it when we get back on the other side.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Teresa Tomeo, and Father Mitch Pacwa. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Talking movies today, twice a year. Oh, yeah, at least we're up to twice a year. Maybe we'll get up to four times a year. We'll see. I don't know. I love talking with Andrew Pettiprin, our guest. He's the author of Popcorn with the Pope, A Guide to the Vatican Film List. If you're Catholic and interested in movies at all, that's a book that you should have, Popcorn with the Pope. Check it out. And so we're talking about the movies of this year. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about what's to come. At the moment, Wicked. This was a huge, huge Broadway hit, Wicked. And it was when my daughters were in middle school. So I have heard every song from Wicked at least 1,000 times because of that CD, which I eventually lost, quote unquote, lost the Wicked CD. So tell us about the movie Wicked.
Yeah, well, Si, my daughter is a middle school girl right now. Okay. She's 13, and she's a singer and a dancer, mostly a dancer, but she loves, you know, she wants to be on Broadway, and she's super talented, and I'm just so proud of her. I hope she's listening now. Hi, Amy.
Hi,
Amy. I hope she is. We'll see. So it was her 13th birthday, and she wanted to go see Wicked at the movie theater, and I totally get it, and I was down for that, to be,
heck yeah,
you know, a fun-loving dad and just have fun at the movies. But I have to say, I did not love the movie. My daughter did. I think my wife did. It seemed like, you know, it seemed like a lot of people have liked it. You know, I didn't love it. It wasn't my cup of tea. But, you know, Si, one of the reasons I didn't love it is I am a little skeptical of this whole premise of, like, taking something that's essentially a fairy tale and then trying to kind of complicate it morally. You know, to sort of say, okay, look, we have these archetypes of good guys and bad guys. Let's imagine that maybe the good guys aren't really so good and the bad guys aren't really so bad. And, you know, if we can only kind of get to the bottom of their story, then maybe everybody's a good guy. Who knows? Now, I don't know. In my life, I think that's not a bad strategy because, you know, as Catholics, as Christians, we believe we're all sinners and we're all capable of redemption. And so,
right,
you know, we want to keep in mind that there aren't just like pure bad guys or pure good guys out there. But fairy tales serve a really special purpose in our cultures, you know, to kind of like give us this kind of archetypal mindset where we sort of understand like the consequences of choices that we make and the idea that there are things worth fighting for and there are things that go bad and need to be, you know, either done away with or reformed or something like that. And so, you know, the original Wizard of Oz, which I had the privilege of writing about in my book that you mentioned, in the book that I co-wrote with David Baird and Michael Ward, Popcorn with the Pope, I love the original Wizard of Oz. And, you know, there are some morally complicated characters in that original story, the wizard being one of them. But I don't know, Wicked to me is just kind of like, you take the Wicked Witch and you sort of try to turn her into the good guy. I don't know. Doesn't really work for me.
I am very sympathetic to that point of view, that this idea of somehow revising the fairy tales is, and I have to say, on television this year, I watched the entire second season of the Tolkien thing that they're doing over at the Rings of Power over at Amazon. And every Tolkien fan, every Tolkien fan is like, I hate that show. I've watched every episode of it. I hate that show. But I've watched every episode twice. You know, but because you're just trying to get your Tolkien fix. But one thing that I really worried about was that they were going to try to make us understand Sauron. They were going to try to make us, and that is absolutely antithetical to what Tolkien is about. Evil in Tolkien is really genuinely evil, and it's inexplicable. Mm-hmm. You can't explain it away. You can't generate a motive that you can go, oh, I understand now. It is utterly baffling why a good creature the predecessor, you know, the creature that was the angel who became this devil, Sauron. Yeah. Why? But once he's a devil, he's a devil. And don't try to understand him, because you're just going to get caught in a web. And I think I felt like in that second season, they were at least smart enough to not try to make Sauron a sympathetic character. They showed Sauron as a manipulator who tries to make himself a sympathetic character to others. But underneath it, they didn't see him as a sympathetic character. And there's something important about that.
I'm glad to hear that. I actually haven't seen much of that show. And maybe it's because I'm maybe a rare Tolkien fan who kind of doesn't love watching a lot of Tolkien representation on screen. I like Peter Jackson's movies just fine, but I love the images that the books have sort of left in my mind, and yeah. I like to go back to the books a lot. So I'm not like itching for more like kind of legendarium stuff like probably a lot of Tolkien fans are. So I've kind of stayed away from the Amazon show. But I'm glad to hear that. I mean, yeah, because Sauron is, I mean, if in the kind of cosmology or whatever of Tolkien, he's kind of akin to an angel, then, I mean, an angel is a creature of pure will. So, I mean, when the angel's will turns against God, then that's that. There isn't any, like, redemption for the angel in the same way that there is for us humans, because we have bodies, we have, you know, we're more complex creatures in a sense, like, that God is able to redeem because our will can be brought back to him over and over again. So, yeah, that's interesting.
So, but why? So Wicked is an exercise then in taking the what were clear moral categories and muddying them. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would say, well, that's good. We're teaching children to see the gray areas. Life is full of gray.
Yeah, I get that. And I don't think Wicked is the end of the world in that regard.
Well, you're wrong. Forget it. Let's get rid of it. Never have him on the show again. Wicked is clearly the end of the world. Where's your sense of drama?
You know, Si, even in my own family, I get a little bit of this kind of, you know, lighten up dad,
yes.
You know, about stuff like this, right? Because I don't need to read like all of kind of I don't need to go all the way back to Aristotle's Poetics or something in every single piece of literature or film or whatever that I interpret. But I don't know, there's just something particular, maybe it's just because I've seen The Wizard of Oz so many times, and I just have those categories of good and evil in my mind that are attached to that movie, that Wicked kind of bothers me. Maybe one of the other reasons is Wicked was kind of the first of its kind to do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where we see it all the time now, right? Like Maleficent is like that. And, you know, there are a whole lot of these sort of, you know, turning the fairy tale or retelling a story from the perspective of the bad guy or whatever. And when I think the author of the original book's name was Gregory Maguire, when his book came out in the 90s, The Wicked Book, it made such a huge splash because nobody had really thought to do that before, with maybe a few exceptions. So I don't know, maybe I'm just a little sensitive, but the songs are good. There's Stephen Schwartz, you know, he's a great Broadway guy, West End guy or whatever. And so I totally get it if you want to just go and have fun and sing along to the songs. It's fun. And I actually think we need more musicals. I think musicals are really fun and great. And a lot of movies are kind of a drag. Musicals are fun.
Yeah. Yeah, here's my thing about musicals. Are there performers that like can the movie stars of today do what the movie stars of 1945 could do? I'm not sure that they can. I don't think they.
No.
I mean, in some ways, like you hear Judy Garland, and she's just so magnificent. But you also realize she was basically tortured as a child to becoming that, to developing that. There's something so beautiful about her, but I don't know if we want to go back to that system that was producing Judy Garland's.
Definitely not. We don't want to go back to the casting couch or anything like that. But you do sometimes watch these old movies and you realize, like, some of these old movie stars, they were trained in vaudeville. They were trained for the stage, you know, all this stuff. So they had all these skills that actually people nowadays that we see on the big screen, they've never really experienced that. I mean, in this movie, in the Wicked movie, you have Ariana Grande, at least, who is like an actual recording star, singer, you know?
Right.
So she knows what she's doing with her voice, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah, but like James Cagney, the great villain of so many mobster movies, is also just one of the great dancers and singers of his era. And so didn't he do Yankee Doodle Dandy? I think he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he played George M. Cohan in Yankee Doodle Dandy. That's one of my favorites. I love that.
Yeah. So you'd like to see more musicals, but there is a thing about that why can't we just enjoy a story that follows there almost seems to me, now this is going to be maybe drawing too much out of something, but it does seem to me that we have a certain cultural self-loathing that we don't want to believe in good guys and bad guys anymore. We don't, and certainly errors were made in Hollywood movies where, okay, how many movies can the Native American people be portrayed as the bad guys? Like that's clear, but it's not the same when you're talking about a green witch. She's not an oppressed minority. There seems to me there's some other loathing in us that we just don't want to, we don't want to have any moral certitude because we don't think we're worthy of moral certitude anymore.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. We're losing our grasp on the categories of good and evil and right and wrong, and maybe even worse, our mindset is flipped on these things. So, you know, everything we used to think was good is now bad, and so now we need to sort of take all the old stories and flip them around. I say, why not make new stories with people who don't look like the good guys in the old movies, but make them the good guys? That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, because there are good guys who look like every single race, every single type of person, or whatever it may be, whatever kind of category we're talking about, you know? Write some new stuff.
Right. And it doesn't, it doesn't have to be, there is an implicit critique of this treasure that we have of the Wizard of Oz. If you do a kind of sequel to it or something that takes its universe and deconstructs it morally, there is an implicit critique that they were wrong and we're right about morals.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, we were talking off mic about how this movie, Wicked, is actually, I didn't know this going into the movie theater, is actually Wicked Part 1. So I guess there's going to be a Wicked Part 2, but when I was walking out of the movie theater, I said to my wife, isn't The Wizard of Oz just Wicked Part 2? I mean, like, we know what comes next. Yeah. We know what the rest of the story is.
Right, yeah. That's funny. So I don't know how they did it, though. Did they do the whole musical and now there's going to be another? Or did they actually stop halfway through what I would recognize from both of my daughters' dad? We're driving home from school. Could we put the Wicked CD on again? Like, and then we took him to the theater to see Wicked when it was in Los Angeles. And it's one of my great experiences as a father, because my younger daughter, when the Elphaba, I think it is, hits the high note at the end of Act One, my daughter's standing in the theater. I think she's like 11 at the time, just tears streaming down her face. Like, this is the greatest moment of my life. Like, she just hit that note. And you feel so great as a parent when you have a moment like that for your child. But is that where it ends? Does it just end like Act One of the...
My understanding is, my daughter anyway, and my wife and others I've talked to who know the musical, because I don't really know it very well, they can't think of any songs that were left out.
Oh.
So I I don't really know where it's going to go from here. I don't know if they're going to come up with some new songs or if they're mistaken. You might have to talk to another film expert about that. I'm sorry, Sal. Sorry, I'm letting you down.
You're yeah. So, but the performers, how were the performers? Like, I think Ariana.
It was okay.
Yeah. Okay.
It was okay. I thought Ariana Grande was okay. I had never heard of Cynthia Erivo, who plays the Wicked Witch of the West. I thought she was okay. Not that great. It was kind of forgettable, to be honest. And maybe that's just because I'm a 44-year-old man, and
it's probably because you're 44. It's 100% because of that. Yeah.
So I thought it was okay. I wouldn't highly recommend it, but maybe if you're a musical fan, it'll give you that fix, I guess.
All right. Well, so when's the last really good musical that you saw? Like new one. I don't mean like, oh, I caught it on Turner Classic Movies, but I mean like, what's a good musical that's been made in modern times?
That's a great question. I don't have a great answer. There was La La Land that came out a few years ago, and I, at the time, sat in the theater and I thought that was a really great movie, but I have mostly forgotten about it. So it can't have been then one of those movies with real movie musicals with real staying power for me. So I don't know. I don't know, Si. I always just kind of go to the older ones. Those are my go-tos, you know?
Yeah. All right, but we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more. What I would like to talk with you about next is a Netflix movie. And if I don't know, you're a movie connoisseur, so I don't know if you watch Netflix movies, but they have one on Mary. The movie Mary came out just before Christmas. It's out now. We'll get Andrew Petterprin's take on that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
From its earliest days, Catholic faith has been lived by a yearly cycle of feasts and seasons. The new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, Feasts of Our Fathers, is a one-stop companion for praying and meditating through the holy days and seasons of the church with help from the most ancient Christian people. Don't just read about the early saints, pray with them. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers now at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this 19th day of December. And I say it like that because it's my father's birthday and my oldest daughter's birthday. So to my father and my daughter, happy birthday to both of you. And we're talking movies. It's coming, you know, this is the time of year. A lot of people go to the movies. People get time off, families together. People go, let's go see a movie. And Wicked has certainly benefited from that holiday spirit. It came out just before Thanksgiving, so we just discussed Wicked. But then I imagine there will be people who are like, let's just put a Netflix on tonight. Family gather around watching Netflix, and Mary, the new movie about the mother of Jesus, is on Netflix. Have you seen Mary?
I have. So, yeah, I did. What do you think of it?
I'm like 4 or 5 days since I watched it, and I'm still processing, trying to figure out what I think about it. Honestly, I'll say this, and I do note that you turned this completely back on me. Did not even give any opinion until I went first.
I'll tell you what I think. I promise.
Okay, I felt like it was a good faith effort. I did not feel at all like this was by people who were trying to be in any way disrespectful. As a matter of fact, I think they were truly, it was an effort that was honorable, trying to honor the Virgin Mother. The thing that I said to Tom Nash about it the other day, and this is the way I feel about it, it's not the movie I would have made about Mary. I think if I had seen that script, I'd have been like, all right, well, couple rewrites and we'll get there, but it's not there yet. So that's my review.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you on that point for sure. I definitely did not watch this movie and think these are people who don't want people to honor the Blessed Virgin Mary or to think highly of her. These are the people making this movie are definitely not trying to say something anti-Christian or anti-Catholic.
Right.
I did find it strange though. So it's directed by this guy DJ Caruso, who's made a bunch of TV and movie stuff. I'm not that familiar with his work. I've seen a couple of his movies. He made the movie Eagle Eye years ago. I don't know if you've seen that movie with Shia LaBeouf.
I think I have among seen other that things, movie. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm in my mind, I'm confusing it with the Will Smith movie about almost
yeah.
the same thing. But I'm sorry
yeah,
that
kind
I,
of the same movie.
I mashed them up in my brain. But
yeah, Enemy of the State. Yeah, that's kind of they're similar. Yeah. Well, anyway, so he's made a lot of stuff. And, you know, the funniest thing, Cy, when the movie started, I thought it was so interesting that it opens by saying, like, you think you know the story of the Blessed Virgin, or you think you know the story of Mary, but you don't know the half of it. Or so it's basically like, we're going to tell you, like, this, like, real story.
Yeah.
And then it proceeds to kind of tell the story that's all this stuff that's not in the Bible, that's just completely made up about, you know,
yeah.
Mary and her whole family, in a sense, having these encounters with the angel Gabriel, with Mary being sent off to kind of be this like temple handmaiden, with all this like intrigue about, you know, stuff with King Herod and like all these kinds of things. So it was, you know, it was not, if you're looking for like kind of the definitive, you know, here's like the best way to put Mary on screen, this is definitely not the movie for you. But what I often say to people, I also just didn't think it was a super interesting movie, but what I often say to people who are really worried about or even paranoid about something being not faithful to the scriptural account or to like tradition or something like that, is that I say there is no such thing as a faithful adaptation of like a biblical story, for example. Like you're always, every filmmaker is always making choices,
yeah,
right? Is always
right.
making his or her own piece of art. So like, it's just always a question of degree of like what this person thinks about the topic, about the characters, whatever. But this one had a lot of stuff that I just kind of thought, okay, this is like let's make a movie about this biblical character called Mary that really is just our own story.
And there was a lot of proto-evangelium of James in there, like the names Anna and Joachim of her parents, and then the temple service and all that. But you're right. The thing that bothered me was let me see if I can encapsulate it, and I will repeat what I have previously said when Tom Nash asked me about this on the air. But the scene of the Annunciation. This is clearly. This is important in the story of Mary. I mean, even if you take out the world context, the Annunciation is the center of the story of Mary. There may be other centers, but this is clearly a moment of great gravity. And I when I was watching it, because the angel Gabriel's there, and you've already been introduced to the angel Gabriel, then it kind of comes on you like, oh, this is it. This is the moment of the Annunciation. This is what he's about to say to her. And it just doesn't work. It's not a good, mm-hmm. it's not a well-made, dramatic, interesting moment. And she doesn't say any of the things that she says in the Bible. Like, I was like, well, I mean, it's okay if you want to add to the story, but why take out her very dramatic response to this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think she says, let it be me, rather than, the dramatic response. I'm the handmaid of the Lord. Be it unto me according to thy word, or whatever. Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a little deflating that she just has this sort of like self-referential kind of, okay, all right, I'll do it kind of thing.
It
kinda,
sounded very 1970s pop psychology to me. Let it be me. Like, it's not about you. Like I mean, it is about her, but that her response has nothing to do with, okay, yep, let me be the center. I felt disappointed in the Mary in the movie. Like, that's not what you're supposed to say.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on that. I like pretty well the depiction of Herod the Great, played by Sir Anthony Hopkins. So, I mean, you've never heard of anybody in this movie. They're all kind of nobodies. I mean, they do fine. I think that they do okay. But they blew the budget, the casting budget anyway, on Anthony Hopkins, the great Sir Anthony Hopkins, who plays King Herod. And, you know, I think that in my mind anyway, I definitely imagine Herod as a kind of just real maniac. And I think that's definitely, I mean, of course he was, right?
He was.
You know, he ordered the execution of babies. So
yeah,
what a maniac. And that comes across really well in the movie. I think that this Herod is a real, you know, talk about good guys and bad guys.
He's a
bad guy. No doubt about it.
Well, and Mary is the good guy. I mean, she really is good. I'm not convinced that she's conceived without sin. I don't, that she doesn't seem to be different. She seems to be, you know, better than other people in the sense of being the heroine of the piece, but not to be significantly different. They didn't wrestle at all with her, like what it means to be a true innocent in a world where there are no innocents, where nobody else is an innocent. Her goodness is clear, but not her genuine purity that at least from the Catholic understanding of Mary, that should be there. That wasn't there. But I got to say, there is one moment that I felt was genuinely dramatic and striking. And it's the moment that Herod first sees Mary. And he thinks that she's bewitching him or something.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, that's the movie right there. That should have been the movie, was the something about this. This is an encounter of true, genuine obedience and innocence, looking bravely into the eyes of evil, and evil flinches. Evil goes, "What is that?" And I loved it. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah, I thought that was a kind of innovation in the story of Our Lady's life that was welcome. I thought. I mean, that seems to me like exactly the kind of effect she would have had on someone with a rotten heart, because she doesn't really even mean to do it. She's just sort of standing there watching what's going on, which I think in that scene, Cy, the rabbi is being tortured or something like that, or maybe the high priest even. I don't remember.
Yeah.
It's some religious figure is being kind of belittled and tortured.
Baba
with
Ben
the crown
Buddha.
Of thorns. Ah, there it is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I also thought, Cy, I don't know how you felt about this, but and this isn't like a huge spoiler. I mean, you know, the basic contours of this movie the ending should be known, I think, to people who turned it on. But they do this little interesting move at the end where they try to reconcile Matthew's gospel and Luke's gospel, where in Matthew's gospel, the Holy Family flee to Egypt. But in Luke's gospel, they go to the temple where Jesus is presented on the eighth day. So they kind of like show how both could have been possible.
Yeah.
You know, how both were possible, I guess, in the truth of the story. But it's kind of a funny way that they do it.
I think they did it backwards. Like the obvious explanation is they went to the temple before Herod knew.
And then they took off.
And then they fled. Like this idea of like, let's take a quick break. Like, how far is Egypt? I mean, Egypt is like 600 miles away. And they're like, wait, let's just backtrack real quick and go to the temple. I don't know, I didn't like that. That just seemed like bad filmmaking to me.
You might be right about that. I thought it was sort of a funny, like, hey, what if we did it the other way? Let's see. Maybe people will buy it. I don't know. I guess you didn't buy it, Cy.
No. I do think there is still a movie to be made about Mary and about the Nativity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's certainly Catholics will look at this, especially Catholics who maintain kind of the old traditional Catholic belief. And I don't use those words in a denigrating way. I just mean that they are old and traditional of Mary, of the birth of the Lord being a miraculous birth. You're not going to get that in this movie. So I can see where a lot of people will have. But I mean, myself, I feel like the filmmaker gets to make the film he wants to make. But his obligation is to draw me into his vision, to see what he sees. And that part I object to. I don't object to, okay, we have a theological difference about the nature of the birth of the Savior. Okay, fine, you want to depict it your way. But it just was like, it had no drama. It had nothing to me.
Yeah. I think this is always a danger when filmmakers try to make a biblical movie. I really do. Because what are you trying to say? You know, because like if it's just a realist film or something, you're just trying to tell a story that then may sort of provoke a certain contemplation or something, right?
Yeah.
But if you're trying to show viewers like the life of Christ or the life of Mary or something like that, what are you trying to achieve with that? I mean, are you trying to sort of get people to go show up at the doorstep of a church and convert? Or are you trying to deepen the already existing faith of people who watch it? Or, I mean, in this case, it's hard to tell because I think most of the cast were actually Israelis. And I think it's, you know, it's a very sort of faithful Jewish kind of depiction, as it should be. I mean, Jesus was a Jew. I mean, so right. Of course they're going to show like the everyday life of kind of this community under the oppression of the Romans. But I mean, what effect is it supposed to produce? I'm not really sure. I think That's just always something that filmmakers wrestle with when they're trying to make a movie about someone like Mary.
Well, I'll leave that as the final word on the movie. That it seems like we had a very similar experience of, well, this could have been something, but it just wasn't.
I don't know if I would recommend it or not. Would you? I mean, I guess I would say to somebody, yeah, check it out if you want to. But
Staples to watch it because he wrote this giant book about Mary. I want because and Tim will see it theologically, but he's a grown up. He's not going to see it as a try to just interpret it as a theological document. So I want to hear what he has to say. So I've recommended it in that way, like to some people, like this is a curiosity. But as far as sitting down for a family movie about Mary, I really would say that's a pass. I don't know. I guess Netflix is doing this. They're going to make religious movies. I guess they got one out about Moses. I haven't seen the Moses one. I don't know if you knew that. Netflix made a movie about Moses. But so I'd be interested to see what they do. Maybe they'll get better at it. But this one I'd say was a miss.
I think so too. I think that the acting was fine, the scenery was fine, but it didn't have the feel to me of a kind of polished Hollywood movie that or even a kind of offbeat sort of arty movie that had a really interesting script. It was just kind of it was just kind of everyday fare with a little bit of innovation.
Now, I did not read this myself, but somebody told me there was some controversy about the girl who played Mary being a Jewish girl. Did you hear anything about that? Because to me, that's
no.
I don't know what the controversy was, but if that is the controversy, please stop whoever that is. Like a Jewish girl playing Mary is a really good choice. Just stop it. This girl was lovely. She didn't have a good script to work with, but she was wonderful.
Yeah, she was good. And I actually thought the guy who played Joseph was okay too. Although in my mind, I imagine Joseph being a little more mature than this man in this movie is a little bit on the frivolous side. Although he has a moment to kind of display some physical heroism that we don't know any, we don't believe the real Saint Joseph actually was called upon to demonstrate. But but he was good. They were good. And if anything, Si, maybe it's just a good opportunity for people to remember the Jewishness of our faith. Which I happen to believe is kind of under fire at the moment. I think that there's a lot of sort of, latent or maybe even somewhat explicit anti-Semitism that has no place in the Catholic Church. So, people should see like a Jewish Mary, a really Jewish Mary and a really Jewish Joseph. Yeah.
Right. Well, a critique of this movie, though, is that it culturally, you can't really distinguish the Jews from the Romans very well. That whatever is really fully Jewish, you're like, well, I don't know, like they're farming olives, they're all, they have an olive, like what is Jewish about them? I guess even in the temple, I wasn't exactly sure what was going on in the temple. Like what do they do in the temple? I couldn't tell from the movie.
Yeah, they didn't really show them, offering sacrifices and stuff like that, or show what we believe would have been kind of the vibrant temple culture.
Right.
They did show though, Si, there's one scene towards the beginning where I guess this is the part actually where the rabbi now I'm forgetting who this is, but anyway, this character gets sort of tortured by Herod, where he wants to put the imperial insignia on the temple. And they're getting upset about this.
Right.
Because, there's no, there really is no king, but there's no king but Yahweh, right? So that sort of comes across a little bit anyway. And there's a kind of, there's a bit of the zealot storyline that runs through the movie, a little bit of kind of the Romans are oppressive to the Jews, but it isn't entirely clear that it's because, you know, they have this one great God, and you know, their devotion to him conflicts with the kind of civic religion of the Romans that these soldiers all around uphold. So
it wasn't clear to me that Mary herself had much of a relationship with God. Like, where was her? Like, she had a relationship with the temple. She had a relationship with Gabriel, the angel. But I didn't see her have much of a relationship with God at all.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and in fact, I mean, she seems it doesn't necessarily seem sinful per se, but like even her service at the temple seems a little bit sort of like, well, she'd rather be planting flowers or be running in the field or something like that, you know, as if to indicate like, you know, maybe what goes on in this place isn't quite as important as what happens in other places, which would be an odd thing.
The great revelation of her personality is actually her leaving temple service to go out and give bread to the poor. So there's a kind of, it's too many mixed messages. All right, we're talking with Andrew Petiprin about movies. We got a lot more to discuss. Maybe we'll discuss some. You know what? When you talked about Wicked, you mentioned this idea of kind of morally reevaluating fairy tales. So blurring these lines. Well, there's a moral reevaluation of one of the most beloved Christmas movies going on right now. So is It's a Wonderful Life a secretly communist film? Is it somehow is it morally wrong? We'll ask Andrew Petiprin when we come back right after this.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Some special items on EWTNRC.com this month are these 3-day devotional candles, perfect for the season. Each design is exclusive to EWTN and includes a beautiful corresponding prayer. Bring the light of the world into your home or share them as gifts. The more you buy, the more you save. To order, go to EWTNRC.com and search for 3-day votive candle to see the collection.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Popcorn with the Pope is Andrew Petiprin's book. It's about the Vatican film list. You know what? I should just ask you about that, because I'm sure there are many people who are like, the Vatican, what? Yes, the Vatican has an official doctrinal list. It's church doctrine, if I understand correctly. What are the best movies ever? Is that correct? It's a doctrinal declaration by the church of the best movies ever.
Correct. There is, in 1995, there was issued a list called Some Important Films, and it was divided into 3 categories: art, religion, and values. And it contains all kinds of movies. Most of them are European movies. A few of them are American things, like, for example, It's a Wonderful Life, which I think we're about to discuss. It's on the list. But Catholics are under no obligation to like these movies or to think that they're edifying or to recommend them to friends or to show them in their parishes or anything like that. But some people who worked at the Vatican in the social communications department or whatever it was called back then came up with this list to honor the 100 years of the motion picture. So we have this list. It came out a long time ago. And these two guys and I, Michael Ward and David Paul Baird, finally got around to writing a book where we comment on all 45 of the movies on the list. And it was a lot of fun to write the book. I really recommend everybody buy a copy.
Well, now you're a total movie guy. When you see the list, are you like, doggone it, I haven't seen some of these? There are some movies.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? You hadn't seen them all?
I had not seen them all. Yeah. And we divided up the list, you know, among us. And there are still one or two that I haven't seen actually on the list because they weren't assigned to me. But I have seen most of them. And like I said, a lot of them are European movies. And that's kind of my jam. So I love European cinema. So there's movies on there by like Roberto Rossellini and, you know, Carl Theodor Dreyer and Andrei Tarkovsky and, you know, people like that.
Is Die Hard on there?
No, Die Hard didn't make it.
All right.
But now you know that is one of my favorites. We've talked about that on the air before, and I think definitely a good Christmas movie. If you've got the stomach for the violence, go for it.
Okay, so the check out Popcorn with the Pope. But let's talk a little bit about one of those movies that the Vatican said is a movie of note. It's a Wonderful Life. All right, well, the assumption is It's a Wonderful Life is just a great, beautiful movie. With wonderful morals and a great story and acting and everything. What's the controversy now over It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, let's start by bringing up another movie franchise, and that's Star Wars. Do you remember a few years ago, Cy, when some smarty pants film critic decided that the best way to read the original Star Wars trilogy was as that the rebellion were actually you know, talk about switching roles here, about good and bad, that the rebellion were actually just kind of misguided, you know, hippy dippy, you know, just kind of misguided fools, and that the Empire was really good. The Empire was good. It provided order and stability. And so, you know, the Empire was they were really the good guys.
I think I might have missed this controversy. I am definitely having feelings about it as you describe it, but
it's total. I hope your feelings are. That sounds like total nonsense to me.
It does. Total nonsense to me. Yeah, it sounds like some. Yeah. Of the, I mean, Mussolini. He made the trains run on time. What's the problem we got with Mussolini?
Right.
You know, like what's a couple million Serbs here or there? That's the way it feels to me.
Right. What's the entire planet Alderaan? Right. You know, blow it up. Right. Well, It's a Wonderful Life. You know, there are people who I think are a little too smart or something. I don't know. I get myself into trouble in the same way sometimes. But there are people who kind of think, well, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. Look, I mean, George Bailey is kind of, you know, what he really should have. He should have left. He should have just left his town like he wanted to, because there's no future for him there. Towns like that are going to die anyway. And, you know, this guy, Mr. Potter, you know, he's got a beat on the way the world is going. Like we've got to kind of get into the modern world of, you know, finance and globalization and, you know, and all these kinds of things. And there's no place for this little building and loan and people kind of like taking care of each other. I find that nonsense too. To be honest, you might not be surprised, but I find It's a Wonderful Life to be a beautiful movie about, among other things, the virtue of solidarity, which we believe as part of the deposit of Catholic social teaching, that, what George Bailey is willing to sacrifice for the sake of the people in the place where he grew up is noble and noteworthy. And Mr. Potter, even if he is ultimately going to be kind of on the victorious side of these questions as the world moved forward after World War II, you know, what George Bailey represents and what the town of Bedford Falls represents is a beautiful and wonderful thing where people care about each other. I mean, even to the point, Cy, where at the end of the movie, when George realizes he wants to be alive and he wants to go on sort of doing what he's been doing, he walks into his house and the very people who are there to kind of take him away and arrest him for losing all this money are there to help him pay off his debt. You know, they're the one, they're putting money into the basket too. So, you know, to me, It's a Wonderful Life is a movie about so many things that are good for our souls. It's a movie about prayer, for one thing. It's a movie about the ministry of angels, even if, you know, the depiction of angels is a little bit unorthodox for us, but still it's neat to see kind of an angel at work. It's a movie about family. It's a movie about the love of family and the love of home. And these are all things that we are unequivocally for as Catholics. So to imagine that, you know, this old Mr. Potter, I mean, he, in my opinion, is kind of a really pitiful character at the end of the movie, because he's alone with his money and he doesn't understand what is really worth living for. There's a similar, another character who's a little less pitiful, but that's Sam Wainwright, who is George Bailey's old friend from childhood. And you can see he's a little bit pitiful, too. He's gone off and lived this big dream where he's made a fortune and he travels the world. But what does he have to show for it? Fancy cars? Yeah. Okay. That's fine.
But he doesn't have
the love of family.
I didn't know this was going to – we have to continue this conversation on the other side because there's just so much to unpack here. It's a wonderful – you know what? Maybe we could do a reevaluation of the Gospels where the tax collectors are the good guys. I think Matthew as a tax collector was the good guy, and this whole conversion – Matthew was contributing to society and the bringing of order. And I think we need to reinterpret the Gospels as well. We'll talk about that on the other side. Andrew Pentaprin is our guest. And we twice a year so far, but maybe we'll up it. We'll see. We talk about movies and we're talking about It's a Wonderful Life. Does It's a Wonderful Life miss the mark or hit the mark morally? We'll continue with that conversation right after this on Catholic Answers Live.